Now we've been seeking to establish that the apostle is setting out the characteristics of the new man. That's what this latter part of the chapter is all about. He's emphasizing the fact that there's been a transformation, a new nature has been created in the Christian. That's what a Christian is, someone who's born again of the Spirit of God. Prior to that, there's a nature that is sinful, a nature that is inclined away from God. But when the Spirit of God comes and regenerates within, he quickens, he makes a new nature, he gives new life within, and that new nature has certain characteristics. It conforms to God himself, it conforms to his law, his moral law. And that moral law, of course, is but the reflection of God himself. It's the reflection of God's nature. And so Paul is seeking to show in this latter part of the chapter how this new nature manifests itself. And it will be manifested in our conversation. We looked at this last week in verse 25. In relation to our speech, wherefore putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor. Paul is saying that will be a mark of the new nature, a mark of the new man. There's a putting away of lying and a speaking the truth, bearing true witness. Well, Paul in that verse is talking, he's referring to our speech. And now in verses 26 and verse 27, he moves inward. He focuses now on the internal, to the feelings and the emotions, the passions within the soul. And he's seeking to uncover the fact that when there is this new creation, when there is this new nature, it will be manifested not only outwardly, but also inwardly in how we feel. He says here in verse 26, be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Now this is a very important passage, very important instruction, because it has been subject to a false interpretation. There is an interpretation that says, do not sin by being angry. In other words, anger is in itself sin. But that's not what Paul is saying here. He says, be angry and sin not. And so what he's seeking to do here is to distinguish between an anger that is lawful, legitimate, right, and an anger that is illegitimate, that is unlawful, that is sinful. Turn to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3. And here in this passage, the Lord is brought a man who had a withered hand. And the Pharisees are there, the religious leaders are there, and they ask the question, is it lawful to do good? Verse 4, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they held their peace. The Lord put this to them. He knew what was in their hearts. And he put this to them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days or to do evil? And when he looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he saith unto the man, stretch forth thine hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole as the other. It is an illustration of the fact that not all anger is sinful. The Lord Jesus is the perfect man. He is the only man who has walked upon this earth who has never sinned, whether in his words or his actions or in the feelings and the emotions of his soul. And on this occasion, the Lord was angered. He was angered by the religious leaders. They watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath day that they might accuse him. And the Lord was angered. He was angered. And that reference there is evidence that there is an anger that is righteous, that is just and justifiable. It's an anger which is a response to sin. It was caused or prompted by the sin of the leaders on this occasion. And that is emphasizing the fact that the only lawful anger that does not degenerate into sin is an anger against sin itself. When we come to Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26, we must interpret the verse in light of other clear biblical teaching. Be ye angry. And when Paul speaks there in that sense, he's talking about a lawful, righteous anger against that which is sin. The only lawful anger is that anger that is against sin. Anger is a settled opposition of the heart against that which is wrong and evil. And the Bible speaks about the anger of God. God is angry with the wicked every day. It is a reflection of his nature. It is the opposition, a settled opposition of God's nature against that which is sinful, contrary to himself. So Paul is not prohibiting anger, but rather what he seeks to do is to lay down the parameters in which that anger expresses itself and how it is to be controlled. He's dealing here with the restraints which determine whether anger is lawful or sinful. And so I want just for a few minutes just to consider this instruction that he gives. This is most practical. This is most practical. What he says in the first place is that a lawful, legitimate anger is never the cause of sinful actions. Be ye angry and sin not. It does not lead to sinful actions. We may have a just occasion to be angry on a certain occasion. And what Paul is saying is this: you must see to it that your anger does not boil over into sin, whether it be sinful words or sinful actions. And that's something, of course, that can very easily happen. You may be faced with a situation that provokes a justifiable anger. But that anger must not lead to the pursuit of personal revenge. That's where a person then takes the law into their own hands. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. The Sermon on the Mount is that sermon that really sets before us life within the kingdom of God. And the Lord in this sermon is showing how the subjects of his kingdom, citizens within his kingdom, are to live. Matthew chapter 5 and verse number 38. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38. You have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Now the Lord here was forbidding the pursuit of personal revenge. He wasn't contradicting the Old Testament law, because in verse 17 he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And what he is doing in a large measure in the Sermon on the Mount is to correct the abuses that had been introduced into the nation of Israel that actually distorted the law and distorted its application. People took what was in the law and they applied it in a wrong sense. There were passages in the Old Testament that were given to magistrates, that were given to the civil ruler, concerning how he conducted matters of trial and matters where there were crimes committed. And what the Lord is saying is, in a personal capacity, you do not have that right. It's not your position to exact personal revenge for any wrongdoing. If you turn to Exodus chapter 21, Exodus chapter 21 and verse number 23, or verse 22, just to get the beginning of the statement, if men strive and hurt a woman with child, and by the way, look at that, this is talking about a woman who is expecting. And you'll notice that the term that's used is child, not a fetus, but a child. It is a child within the womb. If men strive, if there's this altercation breaks out between men and in the company, there's a woman who's pregnant, who's expecting, and she gets caught up in this altercation, so that her fruit depart from her, so she gives birth prematurely, and yet no mischief follow. In other words, there is no lasting damage or harm or hurt done to the child. He shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine, as the judges. There's a due process that has to take place. We cannot take the law into our own hands when we are personally wronged. You can think of the husband here, the father of the child to be born, and this happens, and he's rightly incensed, but he doesn't have the right to take the law into his own hands. This must be determined by due process in the court of law. Verse 23, if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. So if the child died, the child that's born prematurely as a result of this altercation that has developed, if that child dies, then there is a penalty for the person who has committed this. Life for life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. That is the passage that the Lord is quoting from or referring to in the Sermon on the Mount. But I want you to see that it is set within the context of the judicial system, the judicial process. Those punishments, those penalties could only be passed by the judge. And a person does not have the right to take the law into their own hands. What the Lord is dealing with in Matthew 5 is somebody taking the law into their own hands, seeking to exact personal revenge for what may be, in the first instance, justifiable anger. Turn it to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse number 16. Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 16. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord. Well, how do they stand before the Lord? Before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. There is a process that the Lord has set in place for dealing with controversies between man and man. Verse 18, look at this process. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition. There has to be an investigation. They have to look into this matter diligently. And behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. And thine eyes shall, verse 20, and those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Notice it's in the context of a judicial process being carried out. The Lord is saying, in the nation of Israel, you just can't take the law into your own hand. When you have been wronged and you may have justifiable anger, you cannot exact personal revenge. Turn to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. And verse number 19. Here Paul is applying this. He's applying the teaching of Christ. Verse 19, he says, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." Now, Paul is not doing away with due process. If your enemy has done something wrong against you, there is a due process there. There is a system that the Lord has set in place in order to come to the facts of the matter, that the proper punishment might be applied. And that due process can be followed. But, notice what the personal attitude is to be towards the wrongdoer. He's described as the enemy, your enemy. Vengeance belongs to the Lord, and the Lord has set in place a system by which the wrongdoing is avenged. It's through a due process where you have a judge that searches diligently and the case is established and there are proper punishments that fit the crime applied. But on a personal level, this is how we are to view our enemy. If your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink. Because in doing so, you're returning evil with good. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. In other words, two wrongs don't make a right. This is what Paul is dealing with. And then, well, just look at chapter 13. He comes into chapter 13 and then he deals with the civil magistrate, the ruler. The powers that be are ordained of God. See the connection here. He deals with the personal setting, how we personally are to respond towards somebody who has wronged us. And there's a justifiable reason to be angry. But we must not take vengeance into our own hands. That belongs to the Lord. And the Lord has set in place a process. The ruler, verse 3 of chapter 13, is a terror, not to good works, but to the evil. He's appointed as a minister of God in order to avenge, to revenge or to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So what Paul is saying here is this anger that is lawful does not lead to sinful action. Taking the law into our own hands in order to exact personal revenge. That's what the Bible teaches. Once that happens, society disintegrates. It becomes mob rule. And you will not have any order. You will have chaos. Be angry and sin not. So lawful anger is that which does not lead to sin. I read this somewhere. If we would be angry and not sin, then we must be angry at nothing but sin. Nothing but sin. But look at the second parameter that he sets here. Lawful anger does not become a hardened state of mind and heart. He says, be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. This is a second restraint, and it's an exhortation that is of great practical importance, because it has to do with harboring anger in the heart, the cherishing of anger, allowing an angry spirit to become settled within the heart and therefore develop into a hardened, embittered, and resentful state of mind. It is what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9. He says, anger resteth in the bosom of fools. It resteth. And the thought there is, it's abiding here. It's settled down. It's made itself at home. And Paul is saying, let not the sun go down on your wrath. In other words, if a situation arises that may bring justifiable anger, Paul is saying, don't let that become settled. Don't let the sun go down. In other words, don't allow that anger to rest within you day after day after day after day. That's the danger with anger. Lawful anger can very easily give place to evil desire if it is harbored and cherished. That's why Paul says in Ephesians 4, verse 31, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. The word malice there has to do with evil desire. And that's the difference between the anger of verse 26 and the anger of verse 31. It's malice. It's that anger that leads to evil desire. And what leads to malice, what leads to evil desire, is the settling of anger within the heart. Allowing to rest, allowing to take up residence until it develops and forms this embittered state of resentment. Let not the sun go down. Because Paul realized that if the sun were to go down and that anger is still there, still harbored, it will only fester. It'll only fester. And therefore we must avoid that. We must avoid it. These things happen between people. They happen in the home. They happen in the church. They happen in society. They happen with neighbors. Situations arise and we become, in our view, justifiably angry at something. But the danger is, if we allow it to remain, to continue, it only becomes more settled. And then it develops into malice, evil desire. And that's what must be guarded against. But notice a last thought here. Excuse me. Lawful anger is diligent not to give opportunity to the devil. You see that little statement in verse 27? Neither give place to the devil. When anger is allowed to rest in our hearts and develop into a settled state of mind, leading to malicious response or evil desire, whether in words or actions, it gives place to the devil. It walks into the devil's snare. It gives the devil an advantage. Remember what Paul said, 2 Corinthians 2:11? We're not ignorant of Satan's devices, lest he should get an advantage of us. And the devil gets advantage wherever there's anger, wherever anger's allowed to harbor and reside. The devil knows that. That's an opportunity. That's a word of advice that must be viewed in the wider context of God's work, in the work of the gospel. When anger is not controlled, it can very easily degenerate into sinful anger. And it opens the door to the devil to gain advantage in the work of God, in the cause of the gospel. You turn there to Acts chapter 15. Acts chapter 15. In verse number 36, here we have a case where there's been the great council in Jerusalem. They've been dealing with false doctrine that had risen up among the Gentile churches, and that matter has been settled. And now Paul and Barnabas, who have been together in the work of God, are going to set out again. This is the plan. And we read of this desire of Barnabas to take John Mark with them in verse 38. But Paul thought not good to take him with them, who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder one from the other. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed on to Cyprus, and Paul chose Silas and departed, being recommended by the brethren unto the grace of God. Here was a case of contention, and it developed over the choice whether or not to bring John Mark. And John Mark was the nephew of Barnabas. But John Mark had already accompanied them in the past, and then he turned back and he left them. And Paul saw something in Mark that at that point was not good for this journey, for this venture. And so he thought it wasn't wise to bring John Mark. It wasn't anything personal. Later on in 2 Timothy 4, Paul writes to Timothy and he says, bring Mark. He's profitable for the ministry. This wasn't profitable. This wasn't personal. It was rather a case of Paul looking at what was the best for this venture at that time. But I think Barnabas was affected by his relationship. This was his nephew. And I think Barnabas got angry and got annoyed because Paul was taking this position. And it became so sharp between them that it led to division. And Barnabas is not heard of again. Barnabas had been a great servant of Jesus Christ. He was the man who went and befriended Paul, or Saul as he was at the beginning. Saul the persecutor, who imprisoned saints, who gave his word, his testimony against them, that they'd be put to death. The great persecutor of the church. And when he got converted, many didn't believe it was true, didn't believe it was genuine. And they would have cast out Saul. But Barnabas went and befriended him. And I don't think that was an easy task. I think Barnabas knew that he was putting his reputation on the line. He was going to come in for criticism from some within the church. But yet he went and befriended Saul, brought him, spoke up for him, encouraged him. And then the Lord sent them out together on those missionary journeys to establish churches among the Gentiles. And now this contention comes in. The anger gets in. And very often anger can cloud reason and sound judgment. And the anger comes in and it becomes settled. And it gets to the place where it leads to this contention. Unnecessary. This unnecessary separation between them. I think when Paul wrote this instruction concerning anger, he may well have had that incident with Barnabas to the fore. Be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. The admonition is true, but I believe also the admonition was born out of experience. Paul had witnessed those times when anger had become an opportunity for the devil to come in and hinder the work of God. This is a very practical admonition, and it is one, when we ponder it and when we consider it, it is one that ought to drive us to the Lord for his grace and for his help. Not only in relation to the relationships within the church, but also our relationship to the Lord. You know, it's possible to get angry with God. Remember Jonah? And the Lord had to say to Jonah, "Doest thou well to be angry?" Jonah was angry with God. Well, we might read that and think that's impossible, but it's not impossible. We can get angry with God himself. And that, of course, is a situation that we need to guard most diligently against. Very easy for that anger to become settled. And all it will do is to rob us of our fellowship with the Lord. This is a very practical subject, but one that ought to drive us continually to the Lord for his grace and help, in order that we might combat this according to his will. Let's turn in closing in our hymn book to the hymn number 644, and we'll stand together.